back, pulls up the three, boom, knocks it down. Curry from the corner at three, puts it in.
For overtime, makes it, Garrett, Murray.
Welcome to this edition of the MVP cast from me, Mark Woods. My guest has returned for a second spell in the British Basketball League, having re-signed for Plymouth Raiders in the summer. But it's the latest stop in, I guess, what you might call a pretty unusual journey through professional basketball, which I hope we're going to hear all about during our conversation. Dante Nicholas, a very warm welcome and thanks for joining us on the MVP cast.
No problem, Mark. I appreciate you reaching out and being interested in having me on your show.
You're a very rare American, I guess, within any of the European leagues, in that you didn't play in that Division One of the NCAA, which is where, I guess, you know, most of the American exports into the world of basketball go to. And a lot of your college career was in JUCO schools or NIAA schools. And that, it seems, was really nothing to do with your talent, but the fact that you were a pretty late starter in basketball. Tell us, why exactly was that?
Yeah, I would say the journey has been a little unusual, or non-traditional, I would say. To be honest, basketball wasn't really my first sport growing up. I actually played American football my whole life. And that was like a sport that I really loved growing up. I just loved like the physicality, I guess, and just, you know, I just played it probably since I was old enough to play, maybe 6 or 7 years old. And I jumped into basketball late, literally probably high school is when I got into it. And I really made the switch because the area I'm from, football is like a really, really big sport there. And a lot of guys are, it's probably more work putting in there, more strain on the body. And I was just kind of like, that's a little too much for me. Like, I don't want to work out, you know, 2 times a summer and all of this. I played basketball a little bit. It was kind of fun, but I started to take it a little bit more serious probably in high school years. And I tried out a couple years and I got cut actually my sophomore and junior year and ended up making it my senior year. And I had an okay year, but I didn't get recruited or anything. So I just went to community college or junior college and was just messing around basically. And I met a guy and long story short, he said, if you want to, you know, get a scholarship to go to school, you should, you know, talk to a friend of mine who coaches at a school, which ended up being Montgomery College, Rockville, where I went to play. So I played 1 year there and I had a pretty good season, you know, working with the coaching staff, that was there. I told him I basically only wanted to do 1 year. Cause usually I think when you do the JUCO route, you do 2 years. So I just did 1 year and, ended up getting some offers, had a pretty good year. It was all American that year. And I went to Metro State first, Metro State, which is in Denver, and I had 2 pretty good years there. And then transferred my last year to Fresno Pacific, which was, NAIA, and had a pretty good season there. But I guess, yeah, I liked college so much, I just wanted to stick around as long as possible, I guess. I don't know. It was all at different stops. I feel like I was pretty productive and had pretty good careers there. And they all helped me, you know, I think they all added something to my game along the journey. So I think it was all a blessing how I ended up working, looking back at it now.
When you go to different places, obviously it's different levels of competition for the different levels of the college game you're playing at. You're going to different coaches. And of course, you're there for a shorter period of time. How much does that affect the way that you learn how to learn the game, if I can put it that way? And that I guess you have to take on systems and adapt very quickly.
I think you do. For me, one of my probably, I would say, if I look at my self, you know, make a self-assessment, I would say one of my greatest aspects of my basketball game is my knowledge and my IQ is what they call it. And I think that's partly being under different coaches and, you know, learning from different guys and different systems and just picking it up a little bit of information or a little bit of knowledge from every little stop that I'm at. But it's easier for me because, like I said, I've always been a thinker in the game and been able to adjust to different systems, or different coaching styles. And specifically because I play multiple positions, you got to kind of have your thinking cap on at all times because, you know, whether I'm, you know, bringing the ball up, running the point guard or, you know, playing the four, even some power forward, you got to be able to think on the fly. And I think that's something that I've actually been able to use to my benefit as my career has gone on.
Do you think it held you back in any way? Because everyone kind of looks at those big Division I schools, your Kentuckys or Notre Dames or whatever, Dukes of this world. But what kind of difference, or maybe in a positive way, did you get from going to different places and maybe being able to develop at your own pace as opposed to maybe sitting on a bench and not playing and someone wanting you to have that impact and maybe not being ready and then, you know, having to just sit there and not really learn from playing?
I think it definitely had an impact on the player that I became. Honestly, I had some D1 offers, but it was for less years because I don't know if you're aware, the way the clock works, your time works in America for college is a little bit different. So D1 gives you, or at the time, I don't know if they change it, but they give you 5 years after you graduate to play 4 years. And then Division II, they give you, I believe it was 10 full-time semesters to play 8 full-time semesters. So because I went to JUCO, a lot of my clock had already started for D1. So I would have had 2 years to play D1 and 3 years to play D2. So I figured if I would go D2, go to one of the best schools. And at the time, Metro State was probably the winningest Division II program. They basically were run like a Division I program, to be honest. They could be D1. We scrimmaged a lot of D1 schools in the Colorado, and we beat them, or we were, you know, right up there with them. A lot of guys didn't even want to put us on the schedule because they knew how dangerous that school was, to be honest. I'm not going to say what schools those were, but I think it helped me. It helped develop my game because I had, you know, a little bit extra time because I got into basketball so late. And I became, I think at Metro, I definitely became, or I started taking steps to be the player that I wanted to be in the rest of my career. And I think it helped me learn, you know, work ethic. I definitely developed there and, you know, just learning the game as a whole versus just being out there and just rolling the ball out and playing and being like a student of the game.
Metro's in Denver, of course. And I know when you were there, you got a hang around a little bit with the guys from the Nuggets. I mean, what's that like for a, you know, a young college player? Suddenly you're with these NBA guys and you're kind of just hanging or talking ball or maybe, you know, playing pickup, whatever.
It was probably the greatest time of my life, to be honest. I am still a big Carmelo Anthony fan. And one of the perks of me signing at Metro, how they presented it to me, was we get to work his summer basketball camp that he holds in Denver. And I was like, oh man, you know, I was all about it. But we ended up after the camp, they let us play with the guys. Some of the Nuggets came up just after, just a little closed open run. So we got to play with the guys and, you know, that was cool. But then over the time, we kind of built, we had like a small group of friends who, were, some of the younger Nuggets at that time, like Sonny Weems, who was there, Ronaldo Bogman, and J.R. Smith was probably part of that group at that time, too. They would all come. We would have them play, you know, when they're off days, they would come over and play at the dorms that we lived in because we had two NBA-sized courts there, and we all just kind of developed a friendship. So they lived pretty close to where we stayed at on campus, so sometimes we would just go over there, maybe play Xbox, just hang out, you know, and talk about life or whatever. And it was pretty fun at that point. Like you said, you're a young college guy and you're hanging out with these NBA guys. You get to see the contrast in lifestyles pretty much. But I think it was a good experience for me at that point in my life.
I know you became reasonably close with J.R. Smith. I mean, we always kind of see him from the outside. It's a unique personality. What's he like up close?
At that time, JR was just, I mean, they were pretty much like us. They were all young, you know, young guys in the league at that point. Some were rookies, some were like 2 or 3 year guys. JR was a little bit older, but he still was, you know, he just was like a regular kid in the NBA. He just had, you know, millions of dollars, and he played in, you know, one of the best leagues in the world. I mean, he played video games. One of the things we used to do is go over his house all the time because he played Call of Duty, and he had like this 65-inch, maybe 70-inch TV and like all the games. So we would just, you know, whenever we had free time, we would go over there and play video games or whatever, just go to the mall. It was just basic stuff. I mean, they're pretty, you know, people see them from the outside, but they're pretty regular. Like, they do the same thing you do. It's just, you know, they're probably a little bit higher on the pedestal because of their, you know, their jobs or whatever.
And they got better cars.
Yeah, much better cars. Yeah, he had like 5 or 6 or something. Yeah, it was crazy.
Your first job out of college was in the D-League or the G-League, as it's now called, in the year. And I think it was the Santa Cruz Warriors. So, yeah, obviously, that's the point where you come out. The NBA's just over the horizon, and then you get cut.
Yeah.
How tough is that to kind of deal with? That you kind of make that ascent, and suddenly it's that bump in the road?
To be honest, it left me kind of like not knowing, you know, kind of lost in a sense, because my last year when I was at Fresno Pacific, I had a really good season, and I did the whole process. Like, for people who don't know, you have to like declare for the NBA draft to be eligible for, the G League draft. So at that point I'm like, okay, everything's working. I got a letter from the NBA that said I declared. I'm like, okay, this is how it's going to go. Like, I'm going to finish. I'm going to go to the D League. And then once I did get cut, it was like, oh man, like what now kind of thing. I literally went back home, and I was just kind of trying to figure out, you know, life. Cause at that point I didn't have an agent, because I'm like, you know, I'm going to the D League. I'm going to play, you know, I'm one good, you know, injury away from getting called up, you know, and getting my chance in the NBA. And when it didn't go that way, I had to kind of figure things out. So I just started working a regular job. Still trying to, still playing. The good thing about where I'm from, that DC area, is there's good basketball there, and there's good, you know, there's a lot of pros everywhere there. I would go on record to say we have the best basketball in the world, honestly, in that area. So I did semi-pro just because I heard from older guys who have played professionally that they don't, you know, a lot of teams and scouts don't want to see that you're not active or you're just sitting around. They don't want to see a gap in your resume. So I played semi-pro there with some guys I had went to school with, just to stay active, get film. And I was working a regular job, just trying to stay ready, because at that point the D League had said, you know, we could still call you back, so we want you to stay ready. And you just never know. So I just was kind of just waiting for my opportunity, I guess is the best way to put it.
What was the regular job?
At that point, well, I had worked a bunch of jobs, to be honest. I delivered newspapers for a little bit. I worked at a UPS factory loading trucks. I worked at an appliance store. I used to sell kitchen packages, if you could believe that. I was pretty good at it too, but yeah, I did everything, man. I was just trying to pay the bills at that point. So
what's the point that when you sort of look at this, and everyone's chasing the dream in basketball, and everyone's kind of looking for the next step, and you get the NBA G League, that route comes to an end of that particular journey. What's the point where you think, you know what, I'll try overseas?
I wish I could tell you that I did something different. I think a lot of this, and I tell a lot of the younger guys that I help out back home, it's just meeting the right people and having that opportunity come to you and being ready for it when it comes. Because thankfully, through, you know, just knowing guys, one of my assistant coaches at a school that I went to actually played in the first league in Australia that I played in. And he asked me, you know, he reached out and he's like, what are you doing? You still want to play? And I was like, absolutely. And he was like, well, I got an opportunity, whatever, whatever. And I was 100% on board. I was, it wasn't where I wanted to be, but at that point, and in most part, you have to just take that opportunity and make the best of it and go from there. And that's what I did. So I just, like I said, I was working. He said, you know, it starts here. I told, you know, I put my 2 weeks in. I was like, I'm just going to take this opportunity. And then if worst case scenario doesn't work, I come back and get a job, or, you know, best case scenario, it works and it springboards me onto something better. So you just, you kind of just got to be ready and, you know, always network. Cause a lot of it is, it's less about what you can do and who you know, unfortunately. But that's just the, you know, the way the game is.
You're a kid coming out of DC, you're rocking up in Australia, this big faraway foreign country. What's that like?
My first experience in Australia is, it was really, really hot, and it was, it was like, because I was in Northern Australia, which is the Northern Territory, which is like the hottest part of Australia. It was a little different because everybody's driving on the other side there. You're sitting on the other side of the car, so it took me a while to walk, stop walking to the driver's side when I was riding with people. They speak English, which it was good for me at that point. It's just, you know, they talk a little fast and they say words a little different. But I love Australia to this day. I love the way they talk. You know, I think they're really laid out, you know, chilled kind of people. And it was a good experience for me. I think, you know, that was my first time being out of the country, really. And it was a good experience for me, I think, at that point in my life.
No deadly or encounters with any deadly spiders or snakes and that kind of
stuff. Well, see, the thing about Australia is they have the top 10 things in the world that can kill you. Like 7 of them are in Australia.
And most of them all, in the Northern Territory.
Yeah, well, they're all in the Northern Territory or in the middle of Australia, which is like desert land, like they call it the outback. So I never ventured there because like 70% of their population, I think, lives on the coastal region. So nobody really goes in the middle, but. Yeah, they got a lot of things that can kill you out there, but I just stayed away from them. So
probably best.
Yeah,
I mean, playing basketball overseas, no matter what level that you're at, whether it's, you know, EuroLeague or down at a lower league, I mean, it always has a lot of challenges, and I guess you need to learn to take the rough with the smooth. And you've talked in the past about how your mother Donata, I'm pronouncing her name correctly.
Donita, pardon me.
Yeah. I'd overcome a lot of obstacles, and you saw how that worked out when she was raising you. I mean, tell me, how did she inspire you in all this journey?
I think by mostly just being able to get through the circumstances, you know, that were handed to her. My mother was a younger mother growing up, and she literally, whatever came her way, she just kind of persevered through it and flourished out of it, and I saw that. And so when you kind of see that in comparison to like the little setbacks that you have in your life, you're like, okay, so this is not gonna hurt me if she could do, you know, she could do this by herself. And because, you know, single family home growing up, and she was able to do some amazing things and provide for me, then I have no excuse to, you know, not do what I want to do and continue to fight through the setbacks that come in my life. So just watching her basically was enough for me. She didn't really have to say anything or kind of just lead by example, I guess.
Was that, you know, that example of, you know, someone that's, you're watching what they have to do, so you can't really let them down?
Pretty much. I felt like it was kind of a weight on me to not just, you know, not just sit around and kind of just be stagnant. I think because she was able to do everything she wanted with a lot of things holding her back or setting back, you know, obstacles, I felt like it was pressure on me to just, you know, I want to let her know the sacrifices she made were for, you know, weren't for, you know, nothing. So I feel like I had to do what I had to do. So, you know, at this point now she can see me and she can be proud of, you know, what I've become, what I'm continuing to do in my life and also my career.
Is she one of those kind of mums that'll, she'll get up early on a Sunday and watch you online, you know, wherever you're playing, or maybe late on a Sunday when you're in Australia?
Oh yeah, she definitely is. She's a, I wouldn't say her knowledge of the game is strong, but she's a fan. She's a fanatic. She came out here actually my first stint. She came out with my brother, and I'm pretty sure the fans were more, fans of her than me, because she gets in the crowd and she's loud and she's screaming, and I always hear her. Ever since I was, started playing, you could always hear her over everybody. She supports me. She still watches today, and she'll tell me after the game, should have did this, you stopped doing that. She'll give me a little bit of input, but it's needed, at times, and I'll be like, yeah, you're right, I already know, blah, 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 blah. I got to hear from the coaches and the players, and I get home and I'm hearing it from her. But, she's definitely 100% supportive now.
As long as she's happy with your game, that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, she knows if I had a bad game to not really get on me, because I'm really on myself at that point. But she understands.
You're not the only big time bowler, if I can call it that, in your family, because your cousin's Jasmine Thomas, who some people will not know, is an all-star in the WNBA. And a lot of British fans are going to watch her in action this season because she's playing for Pilkowice alongside Joe Leedham and Tamik Fagbenley. I mean, how much do you guys keep tabs on one another over your various seasons and different times of the year?
We definitely follow each other. We've been following since our career. I remember, because my senior year, me and Jazz went to the same high school, and they would have, like, now you're talking big D1s, they would have like schools visiting, like Duke, and all the big D1s would come up there, and we would kind of talk about it. But we've continued to follow each other and support each other as much as we can. When I'm home, because the WNBA runs through the summer months, I always go. Earlier in her career, when she was with the Mystics, which is the DC team, I used to try to get to as many games as I could. I would catch some, just meet up with her parents or whatever. It would be good to always catch up with her. And now she's been kind of bouncing around. She's in Connecticut for a little bit. So I try to catch her whenever I can when I'm home. And we talk every now and then during the season. But, I mean, like you said, she's a big-time superstar now. So I try to give her space. But I'm always supportive in everything she does. And we always have good feedback whenever we get together and we talk, and just kind of it's less about basketball, more about family.
So you never like have a little game of one-on-one in a driveway somewhere?
Nah, I don't want to say who would win that, but nah, she's a beast, man. She's to be able to do what she's done, in her career is just crazy, because from high school, she's always been, a prospect of just, taking over. So she's been killing her whole career, but I'm really proud of her, and it's really good, to show the rest of our family, it's possible. So it's good for what she's done, and I'm continuing to try to do the same on my side.
Let's talk Plymouth. Last time you came over was 2 years ago. It was a Raiders team that had Johnny White as its head coach, and I guess that whole situation has now acquired its own legend. Thought of it properly and covered after the season that maybe his resume in Australia wasn't quite what it had been claimed. It was alleged he'd been working in a nightclub, didn't have any proper coaching experience. How was that season from your perspective now?
Oh, man. If you could, I could probably, if I had like a dollar for every time I've had this conversation, because people will continue to ask me. And the one word that I used to describe it was it was a circus atmosphere. It's been highly publicized what's went on that year or what went on that year. We had probably, I would still to this day say we probably the most talented team coming into that, year. And you can see throughout the first half of the season, we kind of, we went on that little run, but it was a weird situation for me, especially with the player coach we had situation, which was new for me, and I think it was new for a lot of the other guys. And I had no prior knowledge of who Johnny White was coming into the situation, so I didn't really know about the whole situation with his resume or anything like that. I came in basically through Corey Dixon, who was here that year. We had played previously in Australia. I was just looking for a new opportunity. I didn't really know too much about Plymouth. But throughout the year, I learned a little bit more. And then there's just, it was kind of just like one thing led to another. And then, you know, management, there was kind of a disconnect, I believe, between like the coaching staff and maybe ownership and the players. And it became a little toxic at some point. And I think it started to spill out onto the court, and that's what you saw in the second half of that year, where we're, you know, we go from one of the top three teams in the league maybe to not even making the playoffs. So it is what it is at this point. You live and you learn. But like I said, I mean, at that point, it still was a good opportunity for me personally, and I just tried to make the best of the situation while I was in it.
Because it was unusual, because you talked about player coach. Darryl Coletta was nominally not the coach, but was obviously the coach. Johnny was there as well. So when it comes to the end of the season and kind of the truth comes out there, was it really a surprise when you kind of looked back at about how everything had been structured?
Not really. Because the impression I had coming in was we would kind of, I mean, we're all, you know, men, you know, young men or whatever, and we had some older guys on our team. We were all kind of accountable for ourselves, and I think that's how it was presented to me. Like, Johnny would kind of do kind of the X's and O's, but accountability and all that good stuff would be laid on us, which I kind of like the theory of it. But at some point, you got to have some guy, you know, coaching you up and, you know, managing this and this, because to be honest, the players, we got along great. Like, a lot of misconceptions is, you know, players had problems with other players. I mean, that year, we became like a close. Going through stuff like that will make you kind of a close. You, it will bring you together. So we were a close-knit unit. I mean, you know, everybody from Anton Grady to, you know, Dylan Costello is here now, Corey, John Barber. We were all, you know, all pretty close. We all got along well. It just was, like I said, it was other things that became kind of toxic, and it spilled onto the court, and it just made, you know, it made us kind of waste that second half of the year when we could have really, really flourished at the end there.
You moved on, though, to last season to Iserlohn in the German Pro B League, and you mm-hmm. averaged 17 points a game. For a lot of people, that would have earned them a move up into Pro A or maybe a bigger European league. So how come you end up coming back to Plymouth?
I think I had a pretty productive year. I had a slow start year, a slow start to the year there. It seems like I kind of wasn't getting utilized the way I believe I was that year, and it took some time for everybody or the coaching staff to kind of figure it out. So I definitely had a stronger second half of the year, and, you know, at that point I'm thinking, you know, I should be able to move up, because I didn't really know anything about German basketball league at that point. So I'm learning, you know, I'm thinking second division Germany should be good. But then I learned, you know, how it works over there. And I'm thinking I could definitely move up or at least get an opportunity. And then at the end of the day, it comes down to, you know, opportunity, like I said. So I had a couple of offers coming out of that year with some clubs, a couple at the Pro A level, some other Pro B levels, but it just wasn't the right fit for me. And I'm big on, you know, letting the situation be a right fit, because, you know, you could sign for whatever and go play in a pretty good country or something like that, but then not be productive and not be in the right situation or not play under the right coaching staff. And then it just messes you up. And I think at this point, I'm kind of just trying to be in the right situation. So I thought Plymouth, new management, new ownership, new coach, new roster, you know, and I love the Plymouth fans. It's probably one of the most supportive fan groups. So I figured, you know, why not try to do it the right way this time? And after some talks with Coach P and the ownership, you know, I decided to come back here and try it again.
Plymouth's off to a 2-4 start in the league. I mean, it's largely a completely new roster. Do you think this is going to be a group that is going to get better as the season goes on?
Absolutely. Like I told you a little bit earlier, I think we're still learning on the job. We got a lot of young guys. I think what we don't have that a lot of teams have is experience, but the way you get experience is kind of playing. So it's like we got to play, and, you know, every day in practice we get better. Every game we try to get better in different aspects and progress throughout the year, because at the end of the day, we still got, you know, it's a long season. It's still early right now. And I think through, what are we, 2-4 now? I think through 4 games, we probably could have been 3-1, maybe 4-0. We had a bad weekend, but we played number one. We played the league leaders, and, you know, I think Bristol was second at that point. So that was just kind of a wake-up call. But I think we're really close. We're just getting there. We're progressing. We're learning each other. You know, we got the young guys who are learning how to be pros right now and learning the system. So it's probably going to be a little overwhelming for them at that point. And we're just figuring it out as we go. And I think we'll be all right. We just need to make that run at the right time. Just have a good month, have a good November, come up here and put us back in position where we can be not only in the playoffs, but, you know, top four, what everybody wants to be.
You're 32 now, is that correct?
31.
Yes, do you old there?
Yeah, don't give it to him.
What do you see this adventure in basketball unfolding from this point onwards?
That's a good question. I think at this point, I don't want to be the guy who hangs around too long, you know, and can barely walk or, you know, can't really get up and down the court. So I try to, at this point, I'm trying to take care of my body. You know, maintain, keep everything loose, you know, so I take the right steps as far as what I eat. I take yoga. I'm trying to get in some Pilates classes. I'm taking a different approach. That way I can get the most out of my body for the longest. But once that's done, which I couldn't give you a number at this point, cause I feel like I'm in pretty good shape. I know a lot of other guys in the league who are older. They're not, you know, I would say I'm a little bit more active or mobile than they are. Cause a lot of guys don't even believe I'm as old as I am. And I don't either, but that's a whole different situation. But you know, at the end of it, I think I want to go into maybe coaching or training. Cause I've been doing that for a little bit. Every little stop that I go to, I do a little bit of training. And I think that's the next step for me, cause I want to stay around the game. But I feel like I said, I got a lot of knowledge that I just want to pass on. I think that's a missing link with the younger generation, is they have the athleticism, but they don't have the knowledge of the game. So I think that's probably where I want to end up eventually when it's all said and done.
Do you think it's been fun? Because none of the leagues that you've played in are going to set you up for life. It's not like the NBA where you know, even a seasonal, you would never have to work again. But you know, is this sort of unorthodox journey that you've taken been really good fun along the way?
Absolutely. I mean, like I said, I wouldn't change it for the world. I think everything happens for a reason, and I don't think I've made any mistakes in what I've done. I've just learned from everything that I've done. And what I've gained is, you know, knowledge and experience and being able to travel. I think that's my number one thing now. Like, I really like to travel and I really like to see other places. So even when I'm everywhere I'm at, I try to travel to a few other cities or a few other countries when I can, because like I said, just being from DC, not being able to, you know, go around that much or, you know, be as lucky as to, you know, travel to Europe. Like a lot of guys back home talk to me all the time. I still talk to them. They're like, you went where? You went, you did this? It's crazy. And I'm like, yeah, like I want to share that experience with them. So that's probably my focus now, was just, you know, being able to travel to other places and experience different, you know, cultures and languages, and, you know, playing basketball is a good part of it, and it allows me to do that. But I think the experiences I gain are a little bit more valuable than any money I could probably get from basketball at this point.
A few more quid would help. Never hurts to have a few
dollars. Yeah, no, I mean, it won't hurt. If there's anybody out there listening that wants to pay me some good money, I'll do it. But
that's next season.
Yeah, right. Hopefully.
Dante, it's been a real pleasure spending time with you today. Thanks so much for telling us about your journey. The very best of luck for the season ahead and for the remaining adventures you've got in basketball.
thank you. Like I said, I appreciate you reaching out and one to, you know, caring to listen. Appreciate you having me on the show.
Good luck for the season. Thanks for your time.
Thanks.
That is it for this edition of the MVP Cast. We're available to listen on iTunes, on Stitcher, or onto your smart devices via TuneIn Radio. Or you can stream via MVP247.com. Just click on the podcast page, which is also where you can find details about how to support the podcast and also how to enter the NBA Fantasy League. You can also pick up our recent chats with the likes of Flo Larkai, Rachel Vanderwall, and Jeff Van Gundy. A new edition of the MVP Cast coming soon. But for now, from me, Mark Woods, thanks for listening. It's goodbye.